Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. My name is Carl Shinneman. I'm Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Jurnov and the host of ESI Bytes. Glad to have everyone here today. The goal of ESI Bytes, if you haven't listened to a show before, is to make accessible information provided by national electronic discovery experts at a cost everyone can afford, which is free, at a time when you have time to listen, which is when you want to listen to the show. Today, I'm thrilled to have Arianna Tadler on the show to explore a new area for ESI Bytes, which is from the plaintiff's perspective. Arianna has been a partner at Milberg LLP since January 2001. She has extensive experience litigating complex security class actions, lots of high-profile cases. She is one of the few plaintiff lawyers who is really known nationally as an expert in e-discovery. She's co-chair of the Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production. They authored the 2007 treatise entitled Best Practices and Principles for Addressing Electronic Document Production. She speaks all over the country at e-discovery conferences. Arianna, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Carl. I'm really happy to be here.
Okay. And, you know, before we jump in, I always like to ask our guests, how did you first get interested in electronic discovery?
That's a great question. For me, I'm sure like so many of my colleagues in this area, was sort of thrown into it without any expectation of ultimately learning up to where I am today. I was involved in a very large litigation in federal court involving 55 investment banks, over 300 issuing corporations, at a time when electronic information and the use of data was really exploding, such that I had no choice but to learn quickly how to not only ultimately manage data that would be produced in electronic form, but also how to ask for it and to be careful, as I regularly say, about what I wish for, because I think that sometimes requesting parties ask for everything under the sun, similar to what people did in the old days, not contemplating the costs associated with the ultimate receipt of that information and how we have to manage it, and you know, there are not only the costs of the people to review it, but of course today we deal with all sorts of items of automation which cost money as well.
So you were on the hot seat there. Were you a partner at the firm then, or the associate charged with the unfortunate task of having to get everything organized?
I actually was a partner at that point. I had just made partner as I was getting involved in that case, and I had had a little bit of experience before then in some of my prior cases in the late 90s and 2000, because I had some cases involving companies in the tech market. But people were still, at that period of time, taking production and making production of electronic information in hard copy form, such that if there were volumes of email, people were actually printing them out and people were turning pages and reviewing them. There were a few bits and pieces in that particular period, again, the late 90s and 2000, where some information you would look for in electronic form. Obviously, over time since then, that's changed drastically, and indeed in this particular case that I referenced in 2001, that's where we really started to spearhead the notion that you could manage data in an electronic form on our side as the more often requesting party, and we had to learn up very, very quickly. I think, quite frankly, the defense bar had a number of years ahead of us in terms of experience and expertise because they were working with clients who managed their data in electronic form on a day-to-day basis, and that was very different from our actually receiving the information and how one would manage it for purposes of litigation.
Okay, well, let's set the table for today's discussion. Your theory, and we've talked a little bit about this, is as a plaintiff attorney that the Rule 26F meet and confer is a key stage in doing electronic discovery well. And before we go much further, this is a top 10 tip show, but we're not doing this tip 1, tip 2, tip 3. We're going to cover at least 10 tips in this stage. But why do you think the meet and confer is so important?
You know, Carl, I think that the amendments to the rules governing discovery, and particularly the modification of the Rule 26 and the F component dealing with the meet and confer, have really changed the landscape insofar as putting right there on lawyers' radars the fact that we have to be having a dialogue very early on in a litigation. Certainly at the outset of discovery, I would argue you might want to be having discussions even before discovery ensues, but certainly by the outset of discovery about the kinds of information that the parties anticipate will be requested and hopefully will be exchanged throughout the course of litigation. And by having that rule now prominently put this issue for discussion on people's radars, I think it makes us all work harder to anticipate where we're going to be down the road as opposed to simply waiting for discovery. I know with each new case that I become involved in, I'm thinking that much more ahead each time. I'm learning more with each case I'm in, and then when the next case comes down the pike, I say, well, you know, in the last one, I wished I had done that a little bit earlier, and now I have the opportunity in a newer case to do that.
It's interesting how you learn the best from the things you didn't do right the time before.
Yeah.
All right. Well, when and how do you start preparing for the meet and confer?
Well, I look at the meet and confer component as a multi-phased aspect of litigation, and I break it out into both the concept of what we're going to be requesting, not only in terms of the content, obviously, the categories of documents we're going to be asking for, but also the forms in which we're going to be asking for that information, and as well as potential staging or tiering of discovery. That's one aspect of the meet and confer component that I think people are most familiar with, and that's what they think the Rule 26F meet and confer is all about. However, there's another aspect that at least is on my radar, because I think that you want to be having some kind of discussion, whether it's oral, whether it's in a writing, like a letter, where you're also using the concept of the 26F meet and confer to get on everybody's radar the concept of preservation. In the past, prior to this rule being modified, people would deal with preservation simply with a preservation letter, hey, keep everything, and then when discovery opens, we'll deal with those issues later. I like to, when it makes sense, and it's not always practical, depending on the kinds of cases that you're involved in, what the law is governing discovery, et cetera, but I like to have a dialogue with my adversary about the categories of information I anticipate may be relevant and called for in requests for production that at this point should be preserved, and that as we go through the process, I don't consider the Rule 26F meet and confer to be stagnant. I rather consider it to be an iterative process. As we go through that process, hopefully we will see that there is reason to be flexible, both in terms of pulling back on some of the limitations that may have initially been set in terms of preservation, and then, of course, maybe adding a few other categories that it hadn't dawned on anybody needed to be preserved, but now they should be preserved. So the teams that I work with here at Milberg LLP, who are very familiar with my style of litigation, know that as soon as we get involved in a case, we're already beginning to think about what are those categories of information that we'd like to see preserved, and how do we begin the process of talking with our adversary?
And, you know, it's interesting you're talking about the importance of preservation. You know, one of the themes that I've heard from a number of people that have only done a handful of cases is, my God, I wish I had thought about preservation early on.
Right.
Because that boat sails away pretty quickly as data is, you know, lost. And that's a theme that I've heard a number of times.
And it definitely, Carl, is a key issue. And I think what's sort of interesting is that there is that maybe newfound philosophy that they wish they had thought about it earlier on. And yet I find that the producing parties from whom I will ultimately be requesting information there are times when I try to get ahead on this preservation issue, which I believe creates for efficiencies in the litigation, both from the use of personnel resources as well as money, and I get a lot of pushback. They don't want to talk about it now, and that's not supposed to be my business. I think that that is a narrow-minded approach to discovery because, quite honestly, if you can reach agreement with your adversary, and in this particular discussion I'm talking about now, me as the adversary, if you can reach agreement with me as your adversary about some general scope of preservation, it really does streamline the litigation, and people then know what the rules of the game are.
Okay. Now, one of the interesting points that you raised when we were talking about this was about your burdens with electronically stored information. You know, what are you doing on your end to preserve and manage your information?
Sure. Well, you know, our clients here at the firm are a diversified set of people, if you will. Some are literally individuals. And then, of course, we also represent institutional-type clients, whether it's an institutional investor, an actual company, et cetera. And, of course, how you deal with preservation differs depending on the particular type of client in some respects, but in others it's actually the same. I mean, certainly we communicate with our clients, and I urge my teams to be communicating with our clients early on to ensure that they understand that they have an obligation to preserve information. We have the tools here at Milberg, should clients so desire, for us to actually send a team in and assist them. Otherwise, we give them instructions about the kinds of information that they should be preserving. And again, this is on a general basis, but just to give some sense of what those obligations are, and then going forward, of course, working with our clients ultimately to compile their information and have it available for our own mining and preparation for production, just as a defendant in one of my cases would have to go through that process as well.
You know, Judge Facciola has often talked about the need to get experts involved, and typically people think that's usually the burdens on the defense side, but do plaintiff counsel benefit from getting ESI experts involved?
Absolutely. And it really depends on what kind of expert, given what stage of the litigation that you're in and what a particular case's needs are. For example, we have a very impressive team of people here at Milberg, right here in-house. We have a terrific director of litigation tech support, Paul McVoy, who then has a full department of people who work with him to help facilitate not only how we ultimately will manage data as it comes in the door from a producing party, but also assisting our own lawyers here in-house to better understand what they can be doing in terms of helping to prepare for preservation of our own clients' data, helping to prepare for production of our own clients' data, and also helping our attorneys to formulate requests for information from our adversaries, particularly when it comes to the form of production. Because as the rules make clear, you need not make a request for production that is all in the same form. Rather, there may be categories of information, categories of different types of data, that you would prefer, depending on which category we're talking about, be produced in a particular form in contrast to some other category of data. And in that regard, our team is particularly helpful. Then, of course, there are instances where you're dealing with a production that is made to us. We now have to manage that information. In many instances, we just simply manage that information through our team here in-house. But there are also instances when we go outside to work with experts and/or consultants, both in terms of culling and managing that data, but also sometimes there are specific data type sets that really do warrant the use of an expert to better explain how that information is processed and utilized, for example, by one of our adversaries. There might be some kind of proprietary-oriented system that your general advocate is really not familiar with, and indeed maybe even our team here is not familiar with. That's not very common, but certainly there are times when we want to go outside to find the right person to facilitate what our needs are.
Yeah, there's a really good blog post this past week that Ralph Losey wrote on that topic, on the need for expertise and developing better expertise as lawyers in this area, particularly with search and retrieval. But that's another podcast topic.
Right, right.
I told you I was doing search and retrieval before this podcast. It's hard to get
right.
It out of your mind. But anyway, well, let's go back to the meet and confer. Now, you've advocated this is a communication process that goes beyond this physical meeting that the meet and confer literally imposes on the parties. What are some examples of this communication process that you'd include in the meet and confer?
Sure. I like to start a dialogue as early as practical in a particular case with my adversary about where we're going to be going in the meet and confer. So there may even be some initial communications, whether orally or in writing, to start gearing up for that meet and confer as called for by Rule 26F, so that everybody has a sense of what the rules of engagement are. In the past, I had many experiences where you would participate in a meet and confer, you knew what you were going to be looking for and asking for and looking to get answers about, and yet your adversary would sort of end up saying, well, I don't know, I'll find out. And to me, that's sort of a backwards approach to what the rules are trying to accomplish. So instead now, one of the things that I do, and I urge my colleagues here to do, is I send a letter in advance of the meet and confer to my adversary, identifying the topics that I want to discuss during the meet and confer. And of course, those topics will likely include categories of information I'll be looking for, and that's both substantive. It might be if there's a case involving something relating to sales, I might be talking about specific types of sales reports, certain departments and their information. And then, of course, there are the categories of information like data, email, Excel spreadsheets, organizational charts, those kinds of things. I try to identify some of those as well. And then, of course, I also talk early on, in fact, in that letter, about forms of production that I anticipate will make sense given the very little that I know about my adversary systems. Of course, I am at a disadvantage prior to the meet and confer, and certainly prior to the production of my adversary's information. I have very little knowledge about the kinds of reports, documents, data that would likely encompass the kinds of relevant information I'll be looking for to prosecute one of my cases. So the only way for me to really get the ball rolling is for me to put a letter out there and say, look, this is what we're thinking. And of course, if I have the benefit of knowing the names of specific departments and, more importantly, specific personnel, I include those as well in the letter so that when we do get to the actual meet and confer, whether it's in person or by teleconference, my adversary now has a sense of what is to be expected during that call. I also often include with that letter a questionnaire with detailed questions about my adversary's data systems, wanting to better understand, how do they manage email? What system do they use? How long have they used that system? Have there been any transitions over the relevant period of time? How do they back up their data, et cetera? And the way it works is different in each case. In some instances, I find that my adversary comes onto the meet and confer teleconference or in-person meeting and says, well, you know what, we have some answers to some of your questions. Or in some instances, it's, well, I still need to get back to you. When I get to the, I still need to get back to you, I try then during the meet and confer to cull down what the lengthy questionnaire was to give some just very bulleted points and say, well, I need to at least know the basics today And that at least tends to restart the engine and make the meet and confer at least begin to work again.
So you're really focused through this process on extending sort of an open hand of cooperation to try to get essentially discovery going so that it doesn't take over the case.
Absolutely. You know, another mantra of mine, cooperation in litigation discovery is your friend. Because from my perspective, if you cooperate with your adversary, now I can't control what my adversary does, but if I make every effort to cooperate and to share information and to be clear about what it is that I'm asking for, the benefits are numerous. It certainly can lead to both tangible results in terms of the production that you get, as well as the intangible understanding of your adversary's information. It certainly leads to cost efficiency because we're not sitting around bantering about nonsense. Instead, we're getting to the real heart of what information should be produced and when. It also enables me, for example, to forecast ahead, you know, when am I going to be getting productions of certain information and how do I want to manage not only the receipt of that information, but also manage my teams here internally about how they'll be using their time. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I think it garners me credibility, both with my adversary, because I'm being very forthright, and I think I'm being fair, but in addition, it garners me great credibility with a court, should I end up in the regrettable motion to compel situation, where I have now created a very nice record of being fair, being open, trying to share information, trying to have, you know, an equitable dialogue, and to the extent that we end up in a motion to compel situation, and it's simply because my adversary has not cooperated, I think that's a factor that works in my favor. In instances where you sometimes end up in a motion to compel, notwithstanding cooperation, that's because that's an issue that really warrants the court's attention. There's really a dispute, but that dispute is very limited in scope.
You even suggest that after you've had this open dialogue and you've sent your letter and your questionnaire and you've had your meeting, that you send follow-up letters and memos on what's agreed upon and what are open issues and things like that?
I do think those are a good idea, and I think you have to have a decent read on your adversary to determine what's best. My practice in many instances has been to send a letter outlining the topics that were discussed, identifying those areas for which I believe we reached agreement, and also highlighting those for which there may be issues still outstanding. That works well in many instances, but sometimes you have the adversary who just doesn't like getting that letter. So again, I think having a rule, know your adversary, is helpful. You don't always, you know the lawyers on the other side. But in my experience, there are many that I have dealt with again and again, and I have a generally good sense of what their reactions are to some of these things. And I'm very conscious about the tone of those letters. It's not an in-your-face letter. It's really, the purpose of it is to really just memorialize the discussion.
It's a project management dialogue. It's not an adversarial, you know,
that's
it
exactly
can be.
Right.
But it...
That's exactly right. At the very least, though, I would say, if you're not intending to send a letter immediately afterwards, somebody on your team must memorialize what occurred, what was discussed, what was agreed upon in some kind of writing, for example, a legal memo that you keep in your file. Because, as I said, the meet and confer process is an iterative one, and you will no doubt need to go back to that memo to refresh your recollection about what did you discuss and what did you agree upon.
Yeah, I want to talk just a little bit more about cooperation because it's funny. It's something that people have talked about for years at electronic discovery conferences. And as recently as about 14, 16 months ago, I was finishing a chapter on project managing e-discovery cases. And I was talking to a friend out west who was a leading technologist, and he said the only real collaboration he sees is in the CLE circuit, and that at that time data collection and processing was still a mess, and oftentimes the adversary just had to take the data offered and fix it or go into court, and sometimes they would just fix it on their own and sort of muddle through the process. Do you think that we're making, first of all, do you think that's a valid assessment, and is the field improving as we all talk more about cooperation?
I think that there are naysayers about the concept of cooperation, but I do think that we are beginning to see a new movement that's surfacing. And it's really being governed by the issue of cost. And it's sort of an irony, of course, the concept of cooperation in litigation, because for those of us who, you know, have trained as lawyers, we were taught it's an adversarial system. That's how you supposedly get to the truth. And I believe that that aspect of the system is correct in terms of the general umbrella that governs litigation. However, years ago, nobody anticipated that the information to be exchanged in our discovery aspect of litigation would reach the volumes that we have now achieved. And I use the word achieved in quotes because, of course, I mean it somewhat in a derogatory way. You know, in many cases, especially if you work in complex litigation cases, the volume of information can be crippling. And it can be crippling in terms of how long it takes to process that information such that cases go on forever. It can also be crippling insofar as precluding somebody who has a sincere dispute about something from actually having his or her day in court because he or she simply doesn't have the means by which to get to that data and to process that data and to review that data to get to the heart of the dispute and get to the truth. So I think that those people who are naysayers are just not comfortable abandoning the adversarial aspect of our litigation practice here in the United States, but I also think that they're beginning to see, and many others have already seen, that the costs associated with discovery and data management are such that we need to have a little carve-out in this aspect of litigation to facilitate the process, to cut down on the dollars that are being spent, to reduce the amount of time that's being spent, to be open-minded about the use of automation where appropriate. And I can only imagine that over time, as our practice continues to evolve here in the United States, more and more people are going to be receptive to that concept. Certainly, there are many judges around the United States who are becoming more and more receptive to that and are indeed writing about it, encouraging people to be cooperative and even criticizing, if you will, some lawyers who fail to be cooperative. So it's really, you know, a retrospective review, of course, and the benefit of hindsight, but saying, hey, lawyers, had you actually cooperated, had you had an open dialogue, we wouldn't be having this sub-dispute today in a case that's been going on for X number of years. So the fact that you've got the judges, you know, as a part of this process and concept, I think that will be the tool that will enable the concept to continue to evolve in a very positive way.
Plus, there's plenty of precedent in other areas of law. You know, I've spent, I think, 14, 15 years in the e-discovery field, but I had a stint of a year and a half or two where I did virtual law and podcasting with solo practitioners, and collaborative efforts in divorce law is an area where lawyers recognize, you know, that's a dispute where the economics can bleed both sides, and maybe you're better off collaborating and trying to get closer to the ultimate issue. And same with labor employment. So it's interesting how sometimes lawyers recognize there's a problem.
Yes.
Try to fix their system.
That's correct. Well, we like to be problem solvers, certainly.
Well, you know, going back to the meet and confer, does it ever really end?
I think it does end as you're gearing towards summary judgment and trial. I think that in the past, many lawyers have considered it to be, as I said, sort of a stagnant or static aspect of litigation. I think that's a mistake. I think you need it to be an iterative process, and I think in order to do your job well and to be diligent in managing your case, it's important to regularly follow up on, you know, from whence you started and to where are you going, such that, again, you may be able to expand and contract certain parameters that have been applied early on in the case and also tweak certain prior agreements, consider being more flexible to the extent that you can as you move on and learn more about your case. There are areas of information you may not need, you probably don't need, and move on from that and be frank with your adversary, because it'll make the case be that much more efficient.
We did an interesting podcast a week ago with Ken Withers, Cecil Lynn, Steve Badger on what do judges do when they do, what do you do when a judge does you wrong in e-discovery? But, you know, one of the more important bullet points that came out of that podcast is it isn't always a judge who messes up in a discovery case. And in the state area, sometimes it's the rules. You know, for example, many states have not adopted the federal rules or the meet and confer rules. So do you think even without the federal rules at play, both parties are served in a case to have their own meet and confers?
Absolutely. I think it's an absolute must in any case that you're working on to at least make the effort, regardless of whether the rules are telling you to do it or not. To my knowledge, there's no rule telling you you can't do it. And so it seems to me the more proactive you can be in whatever jurisdiction you're practicing to move the case along, to make things more efficient, to make things more cost-effective, the better a lawyer you are, you know, serving as. And I just think that's really critical. And of course, let's remember the persons or persons who we're supposed to be serving are our clients. And the concept of cooperation, the concept of the meet and confer is not just about the litigation in a bubble. It's about serving the interests of our clients, both in terms of the legal dispute, but also in terms of the business aspects associated with pursuing litigation.
All right. The last concept I want to touch upon here is obviously cooperation works when both sides are talking and they trust each other. Do you go into this process trusting the defendant when they say they don't want to produce all of it or much of it's not relevant or it's duplicative? And you know, how does that trust balance play out? When do you lose it? When does it grow?
You know, I suppose the word trust is one that I don't really apply. It's really the concept of cynicism. What level of cynicism am I applying as I go into each case and indeed each aspect of the meet and confer discussion? And it really is guided by the dialogue between myself and my adversary and how it ensues. You know, if we get off to the right start, where my adversary is putting on somebody who really knows the information systems, who is willing to tell us, you know, look, we've got X, Y, and Z. And by the way, we're telling you now, we had an issue with our backup system. We don't have data for March through June of 2007. That kind of dialogue is a very different one than the dialogue, and dialogue's probably not even a fair word, for the banter that goes on with somebody who comes into the meet and confer and says, all you want is everything, you're not being specific enough, I'm not telling you anything. Then, of course, the cynicism, or maybe using your word, the lack of trust goes way up. Why be so defensive unless there's something to hide? So I really consider it, there's a barometer that is applied in each case, and it's really dictated by the behavior of everybody in the meet and confer process.
Well, that's great. I think we've covered this area pretty extensively. Arianna, thanks for joining us here on ESI Bites.
Absolutely my honor, Carl. I really enjoyed speaking with you today.
Great. And you've been listening to another issue of ESI Bites. If you want to see a complete list of all the podcasts we've done and continue to do, you can go to www.esibytes.com. Remember to visit ESI Bites to learn more about e-discovery before ESI bites you back. Thanks again. This is Carl Schinneman from Jurnov. Have a nice day.